And we're recording.
Hello!
I haven't done the intro yet, though. This is just a bit wee waffle that I might be able to use in the podcast. Maybe.
Waffle. Oh, guys, it's too hot.
Okay, we better get move on. We are melting in this room.
Oh, man, I hate Brisbane summers.
Don't hit the desk.
Sorry.
What the... Hello and welcome to What the History, your fortnightly bite-sized bits of bizarre history for your pleasure.
This is not a porno.
Wow.
The heat is obviously affecting Trevor. I apologise for his crass behaviour.
By the way, I am Trevor Holland and I am joined by...
Susie Holland.
And, we're here to give you some little bits of history that we hope you will find enjoyable. We certainly do. And what do you have for us, Susie?
Okay, I have a rather strange story. Well, maybe not strange. It was a whole group of kids on a hot night in Chicago, Illinois, in the US in the 70s. So, yeah, what could go wrong? This is a story about the night the disco music died. And it's about the disco demolition in Chicago, Illinois, like I said, on the 12th of July, 1979. What does disco, baseball and rights have in common, everyone? Well, usually nothing. But on July 12th, 1979, in aforementioned Chicago, Illinois, USA, these three things collided, and I mean collided, in one mighty bang, literally. How did it happen? First, I'm going to set the scene. A time in music and culture where disco had a strong foothold in the music scene. A time where the Bee Gees, the Village People, KC and the Sunshine Band, Saturday Night Fever, Donna Summer, Satin Suits, Amy Stewart wanted to knock on wood, Patrick Hernandez was born to be alive, Chic told us about La Freak, Peaches and Herb were happy to shake your groove thing, Gloria Gaynor was telling everyone that I Will Survive, and Earth, Wind & Fire were talking to everyone about September. I'm bopping around in my seat with these. Woo! Well, no, really. Part of my research was to listen to the snippets of these songs of 1979, and I do love my research. Now, that year, the Billboard Top 100, there was a hell of a lot of songs about dancing. But some people actually hated disco. I know it's hard to believe, but they did. They loved rock and were definitely not happy about disco's place in the music and culture of 1979, or any other year for that matter. So these opponents of disco did something about it. They organized a protest against it. So here's how the events of the 12th of July, 1979, wrote itself into the history books. Now, it all began when White Sox, the baseball team, head of promotions and son of the manager too, Mike Vec, not Veek, as his name looks, but Vec, had a meeting with the head of White Sox security and the sales manager for a local radio station, WLUP-FM, which I'll just shorten to WLUP. Now, WLUP had a DJ by the name of Steve Dahl, who absolutely hated with a red-hot passion disco music. And the reason for that was he was previously sacked from another radio station prior to joining WLUP when their music genre changed from rock to disco. So yeah, he had a really good motive not to like disco. Now, the nature of this meeting was to think up a promotion. When Mike heard that Steve liked to destroy disco albums on air, along with his sidekick Gary Meyer, Mike thought he had found the answer to get bums on seats at Comiskey Park, the White Sox's home ground, and get much-needed promotion for baseball as sales were lagging for the sport. So it was decided that on the evening of July 12th, gosh, I'm saying that date a lot, so everyone, July 12th, when the White Sox were going to play the Detroit Tigers, patrons would be charged 98 cents, and the frequency on the radio dial for WLUP was 97.9, so you could probably see where the 98 cents came into it, to attend the ball game, as long as they brought along a disco album to be destroyed after the first game. Now, promotion was everywhere for the game, which sold out, and the White Sox officials and WLUP personnel were looking forward to a great night to play ball and declare their dislike for disco. Now, picture this, dear listeners. White Sox had been averaging about 18,000 patrons per game. Comiskey Park holds 45,000 people, and approximately 50,000 to 70,000, depending on which primary account you read, people showed up. Some couldn't get tickets and were shaking in the ticketing booths with people inside who were understandably freaking out, and some other people were jumping the turnstiles. So Mike moved security from inside the park to the outside, leaving the inside without much security at all. Now, even before the first ball had been thrown, the crowd mood was getting ugly thanks to the very cheap beer being sold and various drugs being passed around. And chants of disco sucks were being heard throughout the field and around during the first game. Now, the ball players had to wear batting helmets to protect their heads from now the flying disco albums that were starting to be thrown from the crowds. Instead of being put into the bins like they were meant to, some people just decided to play frisbee with these hard vinyl things. Now, so now the much depleted security was ineffective against the chanting crowd. The first game was over at around about 8:16 p.m. and people were getting really rowdy. And then 8:40 p.m., Steve, Gary, and the promotions model, Lorelei, with a very nice name of Shark, came through the door into the field in a Jeep, and people began throwing objects at them. And then they stopped in the outfield, chanting disco sucks, amping up the crowd into a frenzy, with Steve telling the crowd, "This is officially the world's largest anti-disco rally," which of course set everyone into more frenzy. And 4 minutes later, the pyrotechnics crew blew up a bin 8 feet by 4 feet by 6 feet full of records, which flew reportedly, 25 to 30 feet in the air, too much cheering, chanting, and raucous behaviour. So you can probably imagine a massive lot of records, pyrotechnics being blown up, shards of record going everywhere. But it got worse when a guy stormed the field, just some random guy, picked up second base and started waving it around. And that began a mass storming of the baseball pitch of drunken and stoned people from the stands. People were scaling the fence to get in from outside still. There were people having sex in the dugouts, destroying the batting cages, climbing poles, stealing bases, and anything that wasn't nailed down. Urinals were even ripped off the walls. And then the fire started. So extra police and emergency personnel were called out to what was now being called a riot. Officials were telling the crowd over the loudspeaker to return to their seats so the ball game can attempt to continue, and that was pretty ineffectual. And the baseball teams hid in the clubhouse. I think I would have too. Where the blown-up bin used to be, where all the records were, there was now a hole in the ground. I'm just picturing this. Oh, gosh. Now, the White Sox officials started talking about postponing the game, but the Tigers official were having none of that and called for a forfeit, which meant the White Sox had to pay financially to the Tigers, who advised that it was the White Sox's responsibility to ensure a safe playing ground. And then a forfeit was called officially, and the White Sox were not happy about that at all. Now, Steve Dahl was told by the WLUP president not to talk about Demolition Night on air. By Steve's account, he tried not to talk about it for about 30 seconds and then gave up. And there were people calling for his sacking from WLUP, but the ratings that the Disco Demolition Night gave the radio station were much welcomed by the president and the management, so Steve stayed. Now, Mike resigned from the White Sox in 1980 and couldn't get a job in baseball for 10 years. So, my question here is, what do you think, listeners? Was it a bunch of kids rebelling against a genre of music they didn't like? Or was it akin to, quote, Nazi book burnings, end quote, as Nile Rodgers, Chic's guitar player and awesomely talented producer, has stated? Steve has been called a racist homophobe due to his part in the disco demolition, something which he has gone on to record to dispute. And Harry Wayne Casey of Casey and the Sunshine Band said the disco demolition wasn't discriminatory, that Steve was simply an idiot. Now, please see below, my wonderful podcast here, for reading and viewing footage from this very interesting night, so you can be like us and say, what the history? So it really was a disco inferno. Burn, baby, burn.
Well, there's half of our podcast title.
Yes, it is, actually. Yeah. Funny that. I see what you did there.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, they blew a hole in the ground. Wow.
I could just say... Oh, God. Did they not realise an explosion, a bin, records, and a hole in the ground?
Now, how am I going to get from something about holes being blown in the ground to my topic? It's going to be difficult. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a good segue. I'll just carry on and see how I go and see if there's any link I can make somewhere along the way.
Oh, I think you might be able to.
Oh, I'll give it a shot.
I can't see any holes in this. Oh, God.
Oh, boy.
It's too hot. I'm talking crap. Go on, good. Trev.
For our first podcast back this year, I'm actually being a bit different, and I'm not talking about one particular bit of history. I'm covering three quite different, seemingly straightforward topics that are connected in a very what the way, okay? Just I ask that you keep listening, listen to everything else, before you start badgering me about, you know, breaking from the formula, okay? Deal. So what do you think the following have in common? A Bronze Age burial mound near Stonehenge, the graves of 8 medieval warriors in Brandenburg, Germany, and the skeleton of a teenage girl dating back to the 19th century in Alberta, Canada. Let me give you a few seconds. Okay, give up. It all relates to how these sites were discovered. In these cases, archaeologists have to thank a very determined and often aggressive animal, the badger. Let's find out about our first contestant, badger number one, from Great Britain.
It's a perfect match for badgers.
In February 2016, members of the UK Defence Department were stunned to find a pile of slightly clawed pottery shards that had been excavated by an industrious badger at Netheravon in Wiltshire, England, which is owned by the British Ministry of Defence and is not too far from Stonehenge. Further investigation, led by senior archaeologist of the Ministry of Defence, Mr. Richard Osgood, determined that the furry little discoverer had burrowed into a cremation urn dating back to the early Bronze Age, around 2200 to 2000 BCE. While the cremation urn and the ashes of its occupant had largely been destroyed by the badger, researchers were amazed to find items including a bronze saw, a shaft used for straightening arrows, an archer's wrist guard, and a copper chisel largely intact. This had led researchers to believe the site was a burial mound for either an archer or someone who manufactured archery equipment.
And now was the bed of the badger.
Mm-hmm. And there is no comment on how the badger felt about the discovery. Now it's time to meet our next contestant, badger number two, all the way from Germany!
Oh, God.
In August of 2013, two artists living in Stolp, a town in Brandenburg, Germany, were watching a badger industriously digging out a den for itself. After noticing what appeared to be a very old human pelvic bone get dug up by the fluffy explorer, they decided to have a closer look by pushing a camera into its den to get a few photos. When they discovered items of jewellery, they contacted the authorities. Upon excavation of the area, archaeologists discovered 8 graves dating back to the early 12th century CE, including 2 Slavic warlords identified by bronze bowls buried at their feet, as it was considered refined to wash hands before dining at the time. Other items included an arrowhead and a belt with a bronze omega-shaped buckle flanked by snake's heads. One of the warlord skeletons was so well preserved they could see healed marks from sword strikes to his skull, as well as a healed fracture indicating he had fallen from a horse at some point. These details, along with a double-edged sword almost a metre long buried beside him, indicated he was one tough cookie back in medieval times, and I doubt the badger would have messed with him back then.
Go badgers!
And finally, our third contestant, badger number three, visiting from the great north of Alberta, Canada. In January of 2016... Stop that.
I can't help it.
In January of 2016, Brian Rosmahl, a hemp farmer in Alberta, came across a badger hole on his farm and was shocked to find a human skull near the entrance. Thinking it may have been a crime scene, he contacted the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The ensuing investigation determined the skull dated back to the early 19th century, so it soon turned from a crime scene to a historical investigation. It took a while for the Canadian government to act on the discovery, so Brian took it upon himself to carefully excavate the remains in order to protect them, and even had the gravesite sanctified by local Indigenous elders. He discovered the full skeleton of what would turn out to be a 13 to 14-year-old girl, along with artifacts including a thimble, brass buttons, jewelry pieces, and thousands of beads. Examination of the remains and the artifacts led to the conclusion that the girl belonged to a family of some importance. The current theory is she was a daughter of an Indigenous chief, and that she died whilst on a journey between well-known 19th century trading sites. Her burial site sits approximately in the middle of two major trade centres of the time. After the investigation was completed, the girl was again laid to rest, along with all her belongings, in a casket created by local craftspeople back on the farm where she was found. Instead of the badger den, Brian instead chose a tree-lined corner of his property, which he believed was a more appropriate resting place. The reinterment ceremony included Indigenous drummers, elders, and an honour guard of Mounties. It is not recorded if the badger attended. I guess it just goes to show that even an animal, often described as cantankerous, can contribute to our knowledge of the past. So next time you come across a badger, give them a nod and pass on a hearty "What the History" from us.
See, I've always thought badger was, you know, they were lovely, like Badger in Wind of the Willows, who was a kindly, caring, older, like father figure to the rest of the animals. And you know that he was cantankerous.
It's kid, crazy. There's kids' books with kind Tyrannosaurus Rexes, okay?
Yeah. But I bet they were nice to other Tyrannosaurus Rexes.
Badgers are cute, though.
Oh, they are.
Except, look at this. I've seen a few photos of angry badgers. They don't look quite so cute then.
When badgers go angry.
Yeah. Yeah. You would not want to mess with them.
But I like Badger and Wind of the Willows.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Well, I'm not taking that away from
lovely.
You.
Lovely.
No, I somehow don't think any of these badgers were like him.
But I don't think so.
On that note, probably about time to wrap up this episode of What the History. So if you want to know more about what we talked about, all the links to our sources are in the podcast description down below. And we would love to hear from you. You can visit our homepage, wthpod.rufusproject.com, and leave a comment below this very episode. We have a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
Just look for the What the History podcast on Facebook. We do have a Twitter account, which you haven't used much. It's @pod_what. I don't know why I picked that, but that's what it is.
I'm not sure why either.
And as an experiment, if you do want to comment, hey, just put #WTHpod. And we'll see if we can find that. And if you do enjoy this, please let as many people as possible know. That would be very, very cool.
That's right, because it's educational.
It is. And it's nice and quick too, so, you know, it's not a big chunk of your day.
Yeah, because we wouldn't want to do that to you.
Absolutely. And, yeah, so we'll be back in a fortnight's time with some more bizarre bits of history to make you say,
What the History? Good night, everyone.
Bye.